Today's great life is more a riddle than a person. And while people throughout history have stated that they knew who she was and also what she stood for, I'm not so sure. She, incidentally, is the first and most important word I've used so far. The second detail is that she was a poet. And the third, that she lived on the island of Lesbos from the end of the 7th and into the start of the 6th century BC. Beyond those bare facts, writes our expert here today, we know very little about her poetry, hardly anything about her life, not much more about her society, nothing to speak about her character, and nothing whatsoever about her personal appearance. Sappho, she says, is not a name, much less a person. It is, rather, a space. Well, before turning to her, our expert, Peggy Reynolds, for help with the enigmatic Sappho, poet of Lesbos, or lesbian poet, depending on your viewpoint, let me introduce my guest who's chosen her. Bettany Hughes's obsession with the ancient world goes back to memories as a small child watching a TV programme about Tutankhamun.
I was aged 5, I think, and I was so inspired that I wrote my first book.
No longer aged 5, she now regularly strides across our screens herself, bringing to life the Spartans, Minoans, or writing about Helen of Troy. The subtitle of that book was Goddess, Princess and Whore. Bettany, why have you chosen Sappho, and how much do you know about her life?
Well, I think anybody who dreams up this notion that love is bittersweet, or who talks about her daughter as being a golden flower, has to be a great person who lived a great life. But I also love her as a historian because she is such an enormous challenge, because she is exactly as you said, one big space. You know, we feel we know her because of her poetry, but she's much more absent than she is present. And the truth is, I know very little about her. I am mildly obsessed with her. My bookshelves are lined with Sappho poems, with books about sapphic salons. But I've on purpose not dived into her story. It's almost as if I'm saving that up for myself as the great treat of my academic life, the kind of cherry on the cake of classical antiquity. So I'm waiting to learn more.
You're obviously interested in her poetry, anybody would be. But how much should we be interested in what she has come, rightly or wrongly, to represent? I've seen her described as everything from a great intellectual to little more than a vamp.
Oh, I know. Poor old Sappho. I mean, she's kind of drummed out through millennia, I mean, as this kind of rather titillating, seductive sensualist who encourages these young girls into her educatory lair and then makes them her lesbian lovers. I mean, you know, it doesn't take that much imagination to think why this has happened, because she is very sensuous. The poetry that she writes is beautiful, and people through time have loved the idea of women getting together just slightly out of view and a bit of girl-on-girl action happening. You know, this sort of seems to be incredibly titillating and very tenacious.
To men too, I'm afraid to report.
Well, I understand. I understand men are the greatest progenitors of this fantasy of what women do behind closed doors. So, I mean, I imagine that's why she's one of the few female characters for antiquity that we still know about, that we still know the name of. But that's why I'd be really interested, Peggy, to hear if that's why you think she's lasted. It's not just because she's a brilliant poet, but because she represents something slightly dark and murky
and
tantalising.
Well, Peggy, let's start with the facts and then go on to what she's come to represent. What do we actually know about
her?
Well,
as you rightly said, Matthew, we know when she lived. She almost certainly lived during a period when the man who ruled Lesbos was this chap called Pittacus. Other than that, you simply have all these stories, and there's this collection of bits and bobs that come down to us from antiquity called the Testimonia. And they tell us various things like who she was married to, although that seems to be rather a joke name, I'm afraid, because he was in effect called Prick from the Isle of Andros, you know.
So, I think he's actually called Big Prick from the Isle of Andros. It gets even worse.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right, Bettany. So that, you know, we're told that she was married to this chap, but it is a joke. We're told that her mother was called Cleis and her daughter was also called Cleis. We're told that her father may have been this chap or the other chap. In fact, they list about 10 names for the possibility of her father. She does appear to have had 3 brothers, among whom was one who seems to have served wine on Lesbos, and only the very best families were accorded this privilege. So that does suggest that she came from a good family. And then, you know, we have these fragments that she provided these poems for women and girls, not necessarily in a school setting, I don't think, but within the context of a cult of Aphrodite. So these women and girls would have been celebrating the kind of stages in women's life, so puberty, betrothal, marriage, childbirth. And then there's one other little detail, which probably is true, which is that for some reason she was exiled to Sicily. But that's really, you know, about it, and a lot of that is speculation.
I should introduce you properly, Peggy. You are Margaret Reynolds, the author of two books on Sappho. What about the leap, the famous leap? Is that not an established fact?
No, that's...
fact?
Yes, that's complete rubbish. And I was just looking today to see, you know, when the leap, the idea of the leap comes in.
The leap to her death.
Yes. And there's a story about this. You know, the story was that she deserted her girls. What happens to women who love women? In the end, she fell in love with a man, but he wasn't interested in her. And so she jumped off this cliff in Sicily.
Mm.
Because, as you and Bethany were saying earlier, one of the things about Sappho's reputation is that it goes back and forth over the centuries. But it comes in very late.
It's kind of a way of cleaning up the story for a prurient audience.
Exactly, and it's kind of punishing her for the hubris, for the self-promotion that undoubtedly goes on in her poems.
Bethany, we did recently make a Great Lives episode about Robin Hood. It was great fun. And we kind of agreed, the nominator, the expert and I, that Robin never, in the full sense of that word, existed at all. We devoted a programme to Tintin and we entirely agreed that he hadn't existed in any sense. Between Robin Hood and Tintin and say, King Herod, where do we put Sappho on a scale from imaginative concept to flesh and blood historical figure, do you think?
Well, exactly as Peggy says, it is disputed whether she existed. You know, we have whole conferences about this. You know, are these poems written by Sappho?
But somebody existed.
Somebody existed. And I think that if you look at the archaeology of what's going on at this time in the 7th century, there is no doubt that there are vigorous, glorious cults of Aphrodite, and they have an incredibly important job to do in society. This isn't just kind of young women mooning around, staring at the stars, you know, in the setting sun and sort of thinking beautiful thoughts. Their job is to harness the power of sex in a community, because without sex, a community doesn't survive. Mm-hmm. And also, more interestingly, I think, trying to actually grab hold of this power that Aphrodite has to make people enjoy one another's company. She's sometimes called Aphrodite Harmonia, you know, Aphrodite who kind of glues people together. So I think, looking at the archaeology, there were women like this who had this job in places like Lesbos. So in a way, it would be odder if there wasn't a Sappho character. So if you want her on a scale of 1 to 10, I will stick my neck out and say she's at 10.
I think so too. I think this is a real woman whose voice comes down to us amazingly, surprisingly.
Absolutely,
from antiquity.
I mean, voice is the thing. It is the poetry. Here's a reading from something called Fragment 31. We'll come on in a while to explain why it's called Fragment 31.
He seems to me equal to gods, that man, whoever he is, who opposite you sits and listens close to your sweet speaking and lovely laughing. Oh, it puts the heart in my chest on wings. For when I look at you, even a moment, no speaking is left in me. No, tongue breaks, and thin fire is racing under skin, and in eyes no sight, and drumming fills ears, and cold sweat holds me, and shaking grips me all. Greener than grass I am, and dead. Or almost, I seem to me.
I'm almost sorry that I read that for the first time before this programme. I read it this morning and I just felt that shiver going down my spine reading something for the first time. It's never quite the same the second time. What an incredibly powerful elemental.
Oh no, I'm shivering now, Matthew, I tell you. You know, it's incredible description. You know, the blood drumming in your ears, everything. And Sappho is the first person to give us this categoric description of the symptoms of physical desire.
Yes.
And in fact, that's the reason why we have that poem. It's because it was quoted by Longinus in the first century AD in a book on the sublime. And he says, look at this list, look at this. This is an account of the sublime because it is the experience of the extremes of love. And he wrote it down in his book, and that's why it survived from antiquity.
Mm. I would love if every teenage girl and boy in this country could be given that poem to read when they're at school, because it explains what's going on. And normally when you fall in love for the first time, you are, as you say, subsumed by this extraordinary physical experience. And then you do something mad, like go and sleep with the person you shouldn't. But actually, if you sort of realise that for millennia people have been suffering these symptoms of love, it might make you a bit stronger and may make you able to kind of make more rational decisions.
Well, and I think that goes, Bethany, with your thesis about the way that the role of a cult poet like Sappho is actually helping the community and educating girls in how they should live and the community in how they should live together.
How much better?
So that makes sense.
How much better to teach that in schools that
than sex education?
Yes, or the boy stood on the burning deck and things like that. But isn't there an ambiguity in this poem? When it starts out, you seem to think that it's the young man whom she's praising. It starts, "He seems to me equal to gods, that man, whoever he is, who's opposite you." And then you kind of think it's actually not the young man that she's interested in him, but the woman who's looking at her. Why the ambiguity? And if it is a lesbian ambiguity, I suppose it is. Why did she feel the need to be ambiguous? And any theories?
I mean, I think we know it's ambiguous because of the grammar, don't we?
Yes, we do. We absolutely, well, not ambiguous, explicitly a woman.
Is it?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's absolutely explicit. The word greener, where you get to, and I am greener than grass, in Greek, that's chlorotera. And it has a feminine ending. So at that point, you know, never mind the fact that we know that this poem is attributed to a woman called Sappho, the woman speaking in the poem is, "I am greener, I am speaking." And of course, the woman that she's desiring is explicitly this other woman, the bride.
Was she beautiful? Do we know what she looked like?
Well, people don't write that much about how she looked. I mean, there's a vase illustration of her pretty early on, isn't there? I think 5th century or 6th century. So she is portrayed.
Yes, there's one in particular of her playing the lyre, which is very charming. Yeah,
that's right. But she's not kind of portrayed as... She's not a Helen of Troy, you know. She's not portrayed as this kind of extraordinary...
Stunner.
No, not at all.
No. But there is one ancient source which says that she was dark and ill-favoured and small. But, you know, other people have turned that into something rather more beautiful, like little and dark, like a nightingale, you know. And even a poet like Elizabeth Barrett Browning described herself as being like Sappho, little and dark.
Somebody told me that the phrase, "By the Light of the Silvery Moon," a song first recorded in the 20s, sung by Doris Day, Jean Vincent, Fats Waller, "By the Light of the Silvery Moon" is actually one of Sappho's phrases.
Well, so far as we can see, she does seem to have been the first person to describe the moon as silver. And it's astonishing because now, of course, it's become such a cliché. And you mentioned, Bethany, the bittersweet love, which is both painful and pleasurable. That seems to have been an original idea for her. There are so many things that she uses for the very first time, and yet we still, you know, Doris Day, Madonna, Shania Twain, you know, K.D. Lang, they're all using Sappho's lyrics.
The lesbian element obviously was there and was important to her and is important in her works, but sapphic and lesbian apparently acquired their modern meanings only very recently. In classical Athens, the island of Lesbos was associated with sex in general and not with lesbianism at all. Is that right?
Yes, well, it is said that the island of Lesbos, the women of the island of Lesbos, were supposed to specialise in the arts of the courtesan. And it's certainly true that, you know, the name, the word lesbian, meaning a sexual choice, or sapphism or whatever, is only a very, very modern usage. But the key thing to say, and I think Bethany will bear me out here, is that we should not think about ancient Greek sexuality in the way that we would think about ours. Is that not right?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, their distinctions were just completely different from ours, and it's very, very important to mind shift back 2,500, 600, 7 years ago. It was a totally different thing for them. It was a sort of physical parcel, anyway, sex and love. It was as much to do with the mind as it was to do with the body. And relationships between men were thought of as absolutely educative. As we know, they weren't described as gay, or there wasn't a term bisexual. So the boundaries were in some ways much more enforced, in some ways much more blurred, but they were certainly different from our boundaries.
Yes, and I think our kind of concepts are, interestingly, much cruder. And coarser.
Much cruder. I mean, I think that when I read Sappho's poetry, or in fact the poetry of some other... There's a man called Alkman who writes in Sparta, who writes also for young girls, and they sing these beautiful, lustful, gorgeous poems to one another in the ambrosial night, and they sing of being melting with sleep and limb-loosening desire on each other's pretty ankles. I mean, they're just so powerful. But the point of them is to bring this group of girls together in a rather beautiful environment, in a beautiful atmosphere. And we're the crude ones, I
yes,
think.
Yes, yes. And the whole context, it's very sophisticated, and it's pivoting on desire without actually being, you know, sort of worn on off kind of thing.
I think, too, it was an age, and perhaps an age closer to reality than our own, in which people didn't put themselves into categories, I am A this or A that. They simply talked about the feelings that people have and the things that people do.
And also that you are loving somebody because you are worshipping Aphrodite in your love of that person. This was a world where there was no separate word for religion, where the gods were everywhere. You desperately had to keep the gods on side, otherwise the harvest wouldn't ripen that year. So in their kind of adoration of one another, they are performing a religious act as well.
You're listening to Great Lives, and Bettany Hughes has chosen Sappho, Greek poet from the island of Lesbos, inventor, many claim, of the language of desire. Also here is our sapphic expert, Peggy Reynolds. Before we move on too fast, we need to talk a little bit about these fragments. They really are fragments, because nearly all of Sappho's poetry was lost until a discovery was made in a rubbish dump in Egypt over a century ago.
That's right. These are the Oxyrhynchus papyri, these wonderful things which now sit largely at the back of the Ashmolean Museum in
Oxford. Still in crates and crates at the Ashmolean.
It's still in biscuit tin boxes.
They're still sifting, I think, aren't they?
They are. They've probably translated about 1% of this extraordinary wealth of material.
This story is kind of just so exciting because, as you say, it was a rubbish heap. A lot of the rubbish was thrown out in the sort of 5th century AD, but it dated back to the 2nd or 3rd century AD. And we assume that these papyri had been copies of other manuscripts which had decayed, you know. But they are in pieces because papyrus is, first of all, difficult to produce. It's made from the papyrus reed. And secondly, it's terribly useful. So the trouble is with these bits and bobs that ended up just in pieces is that somebody, for instance, has torn them into strips, literally to wrap a mummy with, and you might have this strip on the left-hand side, but then you're missing the next one, and then you've got the next one, and then you're missing the other two, and so all you get is a word, space, 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 word, two words, space, 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 you know. And, of course, you've got to remember that when these things were written down, A, they had no punctuation, and B, they didn't leave any spaces between the words. So if you've got that and you've got these gaps, it's just amazing that we got anything from them. But we did.
We did. And that Alkman poet I was quoting before, that was used, those papyri were used to mummify a crocodile. So you can imagine what kind of a state they were in. The papyri was used as fertiliser. I mean, I think that's how somebody first spotted it. The farmer was just kind of shoveling this stuff onto his ground. Somebody said, hold on a second, I think there's something written on that. And that's how this
Well, some of my best columns have been used to wrap fish and chips. I suppose it's the same sort of thing.
There we are, Matthew. In 2,000 years' time, they'll be sifting through your old columns as these genius works.
It's absolutely fascinating. Tell me this, Peggy. When we discovered the manuscripts of things that Sappho had written, we already knew from word of mouth which people had written down things that she'd written. Did the things we discovered actually match the things that
yes,
had come down through?
Exactly. That is how people realised that this was in fact a poem by Sappho.
Yeah.
So, for instance, fragment 2, which is a sort of invocation to Aphrodite, we knew bits of it handed down from antiquity because other people had quoted them. But then this papyrus turned up. But not only a papyrus, a little piece of pottery. It just makes me feel so excited with these few of these words on it. So suddenly, where you only had a handful of words, you actually had, you know, a nearly poem of a whole 7 lines.
So people were writing things down that she said or from memory, trying to record things that they thought they'd heard her say. She must have been pretty famous in her time.
She becomes notorious pretty quickly. There's a story.
Notorious?
Well, indeed notorious.
I think famous, then notorious.
Well, yes, maybe.
Give us both stages.
Well, I'll give you... See, I sort of think they're one and the same, but we can argue that through. Mm. That Solon... I mean, this is possibly apocryphal, this story, anyway, that Solon, the great lawgiver, was supposed to have heard some lines of Sappho and said, please, can you give me to them so I can read them and then I can die happy, you know? So she's thought to have this incredible emotional impact on this kind of wise man who was himself a poet. And as I said, there's that picture of her on a vase, so she kind of...
And she's on coins from very early on.
Yeah.
There are wall paintings. There was supposed to be...
As a poet?
As a poet. Mm. Absolutely. The representations that we have of her are always as a poet, never as anything else. The stories, so the transfer from being famous, I believe that she was, for a very short time, just famous, and in a period almost immediately after her lifetime, and that then she became notorious. Mm. And some of the testimonia starts to kind of invent this idea that there were two Sapphos who came from Lesbos, one from Eresus and one from Mytilene, you know, the two main towns on Lesbos. And the one, you know, one of them was a poet and respectable, and the other one was a courtesan. So, you know, you get that kind of split. But certainly by the time we get to, you know, 2nd, 3rd century BC into the AD period, she has become notorious.
Mm. And I wonder if that's partly because Athens wrote so much about other people, and they basically didn't like they didn't like places like Lesbos having any power. So anybody that came from Lesbos was, by definition, bad. So Helen was bad because she came from Sparta. So that might have been a reason.
I think that's true, and that's another reason why a lot of Sappho's poetry, actual poetry, got lost, was because, of course, she was writing in an Aeolic dialect. And once Athens became the primary centre for culture, you had to speak Attic Greek. So her Aeolic dialect was considered very provincial and not as fashionable, so therefore her poems weren't recopied and kept in that way.
You said that there were two Sapphos at least. I'd argue that there are probably about 15, but also that there were two phases or elements to her reputation, the fame and the notoriety, and perhaps they went together. How did the ensuing age, the early Christians, how did they take Sappho?
This is an interesting one because there's quite a lot of stories about what happened to Sappho at this period. It's certainly true that one of the very early founding fathers of the church in about 180 AD described her as a gunaikon pornikon erotomanes. So, you know, a woman who was pornographic, as we have the word still, and a sort of... erotomaniac. Yeah.
Kind of nymphomaniac, as we describe it.
That's right. And dismissed her in that way. And we get a lot of stories, and I spent ages and ages trying to track down the stories about the early Christian fathers burning Sappho's works. And I had great difficulty in getting back to any kind of original context for that or story for that. And most of the stories, in fact, come around the Renaissance. But what, of course, is true is that the Great Library at Alexandria, for instance, is said to have held 9 books of Sappho's verse, and it was burned. It was sacked from time to time, not because of the early Christian fathers, but simply because of, you know, rogue pirates and all the rest of it.
I guess, Bettany, that she swings in and out of fashion according to the predominant mood of the times, and also the interpretation of her changes according to the predominant mood of the day.
It does, and also it depends on geography as well, because I was just kind of mulling over as you were talking about the Christian church. I wonder whether the Western Christian church had more of a problem with her, because Augustine famously was very anxious about women loving one another physically, so he'd have hated Sappho, whereas in the Byzantine church and the empire, actually you do get same-sex marriages, you do get women marrying one another, so Sappho, I would have thought, would have posed less of a problem for them. So that would be a geographical distinction, but absolutely, she waxes and wanes like the silvery moon, you know. She's sometimes people love the idea of her, and sometimes she's portrayed both visually and in literature and in kind of polemics as this mistress of the dark arts, as nothing more or less than a witch.
Restoration England rather warmed to at least one version of her, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. She comes and she goes, and from the Renaissance onwards, once you have the printing press, a lot of works, ancient Greek and Roman works, were reprinted, and Sappho is one of the people who suddenly has a new life at this point. But it's difficult because you know, it depends upon what the status of intellectual women at any one period in general is.
Mm. So, and the status of lust as well.
Yes, yes.
Which so also comes in and out.
You do
of
get quite a lot of rude poems around the Restoration based on Sappho, and she becomes the repository for all sorts of weird and wonderful goings on. I can think of one image immediately where she's wearing her laurel wreath, sure enough, but she's also bare-breasted. It actually becomes quite amusing.
All of which seems to confirm, Bettany, that we're free to follow whatever version and to create whatever version of Sappho we like. Is that fair?
Oh, don't. You see, the historian hates that, the idea that, you know, people are just there for us to kind of ladle our ideas upon. I think that quietly Sappho is somewhere watching us and laughing raucously at all of this, because she's become so many different creatures.
Radical feminist, even.
Radical feminist, absolutely. Oh, with those really hard-line sapphic salons that exist today.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, there was a wonderful book in the 1970s called Sappho Was a Right-On Woman. And it was a sort of handbook for how to live as a lesbian.
We haven't heard any of her poetry for a little while, so, Bettany, can I ask you to read this? It's a slightly different subject from that which we've been talking about. It's a call to Aphrodite, her protecting goddess, but also a beautiful description of the place where she lived.
Yes, indeed. This is fragment two, and this is one of those poems that came out from that wonderful treasure trove of Oxyrhynchus. Hither to me from Crete, to this holy temple, here to your grove of apple trees, come to the altars smoking with incense, while the cool water sifts through the apple branches, and everywhere is shaded with roses, and from the shimmering leaves, enchanted drowsiness descends into the meadow, where horses graze, and the spring flowers blossom, and the winds blow gently.
Well, if she was watching us in this studio, I think she'd have rather enjoyed your reading.
Well, I will die happy if that's the case.
Just like Solon, yes.
If you look Sappho up on the internet, there are literally thousands of images of who she was. I don't just mean the snigger-snigger variety, although there are a fair few of those. Peggy, you clearly have strong views on who she was, and also on how men have repeatedly tried to reinterpret who she was. Shouldn't we remember her primarily as just a poet?
I've spent a lot of time thinking about the different varieties of her representation across the centuries. But for me, the fact that this is a voice of a woman that comes to us, a real person with a real identity, and there are several poems, there are three or four poems where she says Sappho, I, Sappho, names herself. I find that so exciting. And the fact is that we are still discovering things. I mean, in 2005, there was a papyrus at Cologne that was decoded and turns out to be a poem by Sappho about old age. So very contemporary, you know, about how her hair has turned white and her knees are bad. And she's still there. Yes, for me, she's first of all a poet.
Does it really matter who Sappho actually was?
I think it matters not a jot who she was, because what matters are her words and her ideas and her delight in the power of love.
Some say there are nine muses, wrote Plato, but how careless. Look again, Sappho of Lesbos is the tenth. My thanks to Bettany Hughes for choosing Sappho of Lesbos and to Peggy Reynolds for explaining so much. Goodbye.